This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
This is London. This is London.
The Voice of Russia World Service.
This is the Voice of America, Washington, D.C., signing on.
This is the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland, with a relay transmission via Bel-Air in the Netherlands Antilles, directed from New Zealand.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
Bonjour à vous si vous nous rejoignez sur Radio France Internationale. Il est 5h à Paris.
This is Radio Ukraine International.
This is the English program of Radio Deutsche Welle, Germany's international broadcasting service.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette Macquarie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to the program. Coming up today, we're going to pay a visit to a station listened to by millions in Asia. Radio Free Asia has been on the air for 15 years and brings people news and information that is not covered on domestic media in China, North Korea, Tibet, Cambodia, and other nations.
Last week, to my shock, I was told that a friend and broadcaster, David Monson, passed away in March. That's March 2011. I'll be joined later on the program by Bob Zanotti and Jeff White to talk about this very special person.
Dan Hensley will also be here with this week's propagation forecast, so stay tuned. Media Network Plus, the show that's more than just shortwave. First, here's Keith with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
The Dutch daily NRC Handelsblad reports that Radio Netherlands Worldwide General Director Jan Hucht could receive a golden handshake worth over 1 million euros when he leaves the international broadcaster. The cabinet has cut RNW's budget from 46 million euros to just over 14 million euros as part of a raft of austerity measures. The unions have agreed a redundancy package for the 270 employees out of the 350 who will be dismissed. A new slimmed-down RNW is due to begin operating in January 2013. Jan Hucht has indicated that he doesn't intend to stay on in the new organization. Under the terms of the general redundancy agreement, he would be entitled to a lump sum of about 450,000 euros. That amount could rise considerably. However, because of an arrangement he made with the Board of Commissioners when he was appointed General Director, Jan Hucht has neither confirmed nor denied the size of the amount. He told Handelsblad that if agreements were concluded in the past, which could lead to entitlements in the future, then whether or not these entitlements are claimed also lies in the future. The new slimmed-down Radio Netherlands will be under the Foreign Ministry as of next year, and will focus exclusively on providing impartial information to countries without press freedom. In Russia, the Ministry of Communications has prepared a new amendment to the federal program Development in Broadcasting in the Russian Federation in 2009-2015. All advertised events this year to implement broadcasting in DRM standard will soon be lifted. As explained in the department, a program developed in 2008 did not take fully into account the latest technology advances. Over the past few years, the use of DRM in the world has significantly decreased, while broadcasters still satisfied with the work in the VHF range and wait for the emergence of new hybrid technologies. The program had a budget of 3.9 billion rubles. Now that money will be spent on the development of television. There is no word yet what this will mean for Voice of Russia that uses DRM. The U.S. online video service Netflix is gearing up to launch in additional European territories this year, following the success of the launch in the UK and Ireland. CEO Reed Hastings said that the company was set to return to global profitability in the second quarter of this year and would speed up to launch further international services. Netflix last year announced that it was freezing its global ambitions following large subscriber losses in the United States. However, it achieved strong streaming subscriber growth this quarter, with the net addition of 1.7 million customers, taking the total number of U.S. subscribers to 23.41 million. Netflix currently has 3.7 million international subscribers and an increase of 1.21 million in the first 3 months of this year. The company had laid out plans to launch in Spain before halting its international plans last year. It is also reportedly eyeing moves in other European countries. Hastings said that it has seen more success from its launch in the UK and Ireland than its rollout across Latin America, and that it would target developed countries rather than emerging markets for the next phase of growth. And finally, Robert Westmore of Southern California, who designs websites for a living, was a little shocked to learn that he designed the new homepage for the reclusive North Korea regime. "I had no idea," he told Fox News in an interview. "Honestly, I didn't even know North Korea had a website." While the notorious totalitarian government continues to spend hundreds of millions on failed rocket launches, North Korea skimps in other areas, notably web design. Indeed, the country spent $15 redesigning its national homepage, korea-dpr.com, a fact accidentally discovered by an unsuspecting college student. Fordham junior Michael Detani was working on a class project about Korean propaganda when he noticed the country's flashy new design, which Detani estimates to be only a few months old. The computer science major quickly realized the site was based on Westmore's $15 Blender template. And well, I suppose if they spend $15 on a Blender template to redesign their government website, makes you wonder how much they spent on some of the technology used in that failed rocket. Anyway, that was a look at some of the headlines happening in the world of media. I'm Keith Parron.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
Radio Free Asia signed on in 1996. The station was built from the 1989 pro-democracy crackdown in Tiananmen Square. At the same time, it is used to reach people in other oppressive regimes. RFA broadcasts in Mandarin, Tibetan, Burmese, Vietnamese, Korean, Laotian, Khmer, Cantonese, and Uyghur. The largest of the language sections are Mandarin and Tibetan, with a combined 22 hours a day. Radio Free Asia works with a network of people who call in with story leads from within the countries they target. These stories and leads are checked and double-checked by their staff in Washington before they go to air. Throughout its history, RFA has had some high-profile listeners, including Burma's democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who was a regular listener while she was under house arrest, the Tibetan spiritual leader Dalai Lama. And sources to this program have said that Chinese artist Ai Weiwei has also been a listener.
During the Cold War, along with the Voice of America, Radio Liberty provided its audience behind the Iron Curtain with news and information that was censored. It was not until the collapse of the Soviet Union and other communist regimes that stations like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty really knew the size of its audience. In 1989, as Eastern Europe started to move towards democracy, the Far East was a different story. Oppressive governments in Vietnam, Burma, Cambodia, North Korea, and China continued to oppress their populations. But on June 4, 1989, the world started paying closer attention to this part of the world, in particular China.
(音楽) 就以为听不到，
而真理在心中，创痛在胸口。
June 4th, 1989 is a date people will remember as the day the communist authorities in China crushed the pro-democracy student movement. At the time, there were many foreign journalists in Beijing to cover the visit to China by Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, but his visit was overshadowed. In May 1989, media restrictions in Beijing were lifted because of the visit, but then a few weeks later were tightened from what they had been. Just before they were tightened, even China's external service, Radio Beijing, reported on the tanks that entered Tiananmen Square.
This is Radio Beijing. Please remember June the 3rd, 1989. The most tragic event happened in the Chinese capital, Beijing. Thousands of people, most of them innocent civilians, were killed by fully armed soldiers when they forced their way into the city. Among the killed are our colleagues at Radio Beijing. The soldiers were riding on armored vehicles and used machine guns against thousands of local residents and students who tried to block their way. When the army convoys made a breakthrough, soldiers continued to spray their bullets indiscriminately at crowds in the street. Eyewitnesses say some armored vehicles even crushed foot soldiers who hesitated in front of the resisting civilians. Radio Beijing English Department deeply mourns those died in a tragic incident and appeals to all its listeners to join our protest for the gross violation of human rights and the most barbarous oppression of the people. Because of the abnormal situation here in Beijing, there is no other news we could bring you. We sincerely ask for your understanding and thank you for joining us at this most tragic moment.
It was at this time that a service to Asia came into being. Then a few years later, on March 12, 1996, Radio Free Asia was born. Radio Free Asia's mission is to broadcast news and information to listeners in Asia who are otherwise denied access to full and free information, and to provide a forum for the variety of opinions and voices from within Asia. RFA broadcast in 9 languages, the 2 largest language sections being Chinese and Tibetan. Andrew Janicek, Director of Program and Operations Support, explains how it was born.
Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, have been around for decades. Radio Free Asia has been around only since 1996. And what we tell people when they come to visit Radio Free Asia is we came about basically because of Tiananmen Square. In 1989, people that were living in China's own capital didn't even know what was going on down the street from them. In the United States, people like Congress were saying, we need to do something like a Radio Free Europe to help the people of China find out what's going on inside their own borders. Legislation came up in 1994 and was approved for the creation of Radio Free Asia. And in September 1996, we went on with our first broadcast. And we've been doing it for over 15 years now.
I find it kind of extraordinary because in the 1970s, 1980s, China, for example, Vietnam, North Korea was under communism like the Soviet Union. Was that because U.S. foreign policy was different at the time that it is now, so there was less focus on the area, or was because the VOA was mainly covering it?
VOA has its own mission to broadcast to all of the world, really, and I think to promote the United States culture and our way of life. Our job at Radio Free Asia is different, and I think things are constantly changing. You know, everything from detente and when Nixon went into China, things have been changing since then, to the point that now China is favored nation status with the United States. But that doesn't mean that everybody has free access to news and information. So in the 90s, again, early 90s particularly, that was when the gears were working in the United States, at least, to put together Radio Free Asia. Again, based upon what we saw on TV coming out of China during the Tiananmen Square uprising, it was a shock to not just people in the United States, but people of the world to think, oh my gosh, this is going on someplace in the world. What can we do to help them? Radio Free Asia's job is really more focused than probably any of the major broadcasters you could think of as a surrogate station. You know, we're there to provide a news and information for the people inside the country's borders. So, again, VOA being much broader in their scope met a need and meets a need, but Radio Free Asia has been established and is put in place to meet another more specific need within those countries. So the fact that they censor their media or control their media more is something that we in the United States don't really have to face. So in order to supplement and if nothing else, support the listeners in the country, Radio Free Asia is there to give them news of what's going on in and around them.
The day after the station went on the air, China's government mouthpiece, China Daily, ran an editorial with less than flattering words, as Jennifer Zhou, the deputy director of programming, explains.
Well, actually, the day after Radio Free Asia went on the air, China Daily ran an editorial that pretty much said Radio Free Asia shut up. But in the 15 years that we have been on the air, the Chinese government has never been able to cite one specific example saying that Radio Free Asia got it wrong. They don't like what we say on the air because I know this sounds so... We report the truth. And they don't like what we are saying on the air, but they have not been able to pinpoint one report saying you got this fact wrong, you got that fact wrong. We go by the two-source rule. We verify every lead we get. A lot of the self-immolation stories that we were able to break, our listeners called us up and tipped us off, and then we were able to confirm the leads independently with other sources inside China. We have a extensive network of contacts inside China, which is one of the reasons why we have been able to break one story after another, not just the Tibetan stories, the Mandarin stories. In 2005, in December, I don't even remember the Little Tiananmen incident in Guangdong, Radio Free Asia's Mandarin service broke that story because our reporter had been talking to local villagers months ahead of time when we knew that they were angry about the construction of this power plant. And so when armed police moved in the evening of December the 5th in 2005, the villagers called our reporter on her cell phone and said that they're using real bullets on us. This is one reason we have extensive networks of people across all geographic regions inside China. Our listeners also, it's a gold mine of news tips. But we always go by the two-source rule. Sometimes we verify with multiple sources, not just two sources.
Now, when you have sources like that are in China, in the back of your mind, you must be thinking sometime, I hope we're not putting any of these people in danger, because China does have a very vast security network. They're very good at observing people and watching people, even though, okay, they're not using a real name on the air, they can monitor a cell phone conversation, they can monitor an email. How and what do you do so this does not happen, so their safety and their family's safety is assured?
We distort their voices. A lot of times we post, if we are airing somebody with an exclusive lead, we would distort their voices and we would use a pseudonym, and we would tell our listeners this is a pseudonym and the voice has been distorted. We do our best to protect our sources, it's really sad that we have not always been successful. In, I think, 1997 or 1998, a labor leader in Hunan province, Zhang Shanguang, he was interviewed by one of our reporters, and we interviewed him about an NGO he was trying to form, how to fight for workers' rights and peasants' rights. During the interview, he said, by the way, as I speak, there are hundreds of peasants protesting downtown at this location, and you should report it. And So when we aired the interview, we did not report the part where he said there are these hundreds of people protesting because we were not able to confirm it. We did not report it. But when he was arrested by Chinese police, eventually he was put on trial. In the official indictment, one of the charges against him was that he divulged information to Radio Free Asia about a labor unrest. How did they get that? They were monitoring his phone line. He got 10 years. When I got word that he had been sentenced to 10 years and that Radio Free Asia was mentioned in indictment, it was just before Christmas, and it was the saddest Christmas of my life. But we do try to protect people's identity. But then when you're dealing with a huge state police, it's very hard.
Radio Free Asia uses various platforms to distribute its programs: shortwave, internet, and satellite. One of the challenges for any international broadcaster is to know how many people are listening. This is even more challenging when you're targeting listeners in countries where information is censored, and you don't have the opportunity to go in and do an independent survey. So, how is this done? And how important is shortwave as a broadcast platform? Andrew Janicek again.
But we rely on a contract company and this is not just for Radio Free Asia, but for all of U.S. international broadcasting, a company that is, I think it's either contracted directly by the Broadcasting Board of Governors or the International Broadcasting Bureau. They do go out and they do surveys on site for listeners and try to get a best read as to how much they're listening to Radio Free Asia, to VOA, even probably others like BBC and Deutsche Welle too. And for example, if we use the North Korean example, again, impossible to get into North Korea. So they do travel to places like South Korea and find people that have been able to get out of country and are now living in the South and interview them about their experiences and their listening habits to shortwave radio. And there is the way we get our information about how successful or how unsuccessful we may be in our listening area.
When it comes to shortwave, up to how many frequencies would you have, let's say, on air at one time to, let's say, Vietnam or China?
I think it depends on maybe the amount of jamming we might face. For example, in Cambodia, there's no jamming known of for our shortwave frequencies. So we may live off of one shortwave frequency for them and off of an affiliate in Phnom Penh, one FM frequency. But if you use the extreme like China, where they may be jamming us in Mandarin, again, there was one time where we had 1 hour of programming broadcast on 13 frequencies. I don't know that we'll see that much anymore, only because of the fact that budgets have forced us to cut back on the number of frequencies we've been broadcasting on. We're seeing that in our Vietnamese service, where we're jammed also. The more we put on, the more frequencies we use, the more likely we're able to get around jamming. The common sense statement on it is for every frequency you put up, we have to put up one to jam you. And in some cases, they may use multiples just to make sure that the jamming is really effective. So if we are not jammed and we're heard on one frequency, great, low cost, not a problem. But if we are jammed and we need to fight that somehow, then it takes multiple frequencies, and multiple different frequencies serve different regions in different ways, too. One frequency may serve the northern part of China quite well, but not the south, and vice versa. Another frequency is serving the south quite well, but not the north.
You are listening to Radio Free Asia. 自由亚洲电台开始播送普通话节目。
We're not listening for FM fidelity here. We're not listening for the latest Metallica hit to be in my headphones, but we're looking for news and information, and you as well as anybody else would know too. If there's a problem with the signal, after you've listened to it for 5-10 minutes, it's almost like the brain helps you tune that out, and you do pick up the information. Even in some of the worst signals that you can hear, even another radio station talking over the top of you, if you listen hard, again, your ear finally fine-tunes itself to hear the news and information. So I'm not there for the audio quality. I'm there for the news and information.
And I think that's very important, because in places like North Korea, Vietnam, China, it's the information, the content that is key. And if somebody really wants to know what's going on in their back door in China, the noise, they will put the noise aside.
Yeah. As I mentioned during the briefing, our service director from our Mandarin service said, you know, one of the things we don't have to worry about is necessarily promoting all of our frequencies. We do that as a service, and it's on our website, and most of our frequencies are listed there. But she also said, too, says, don't worry about putting it there, because no matter where you are, Radio Free Asia, we, our listeners, we will find you. So if they're motivated, they're going to come and find you anyways, even if they can't find their frequency. And you can only imagine the informal networks that are within certain towns and cities, whereas if Keith is listening to RFA on a certain frequency, well, then he tells AJ, AJ tells John, John tells Mary, and it goes on and on from there. So that way, within a short amount of time, our little network knows exactly where to go for the news and information we want.
Jennifer Jo and the rest of the staff at RFA feel pride in the work they do because of the difference they are making in people's lives. And when they hear about personal stories, their impact means even more.
I pride myself on the fact that every day we make a difference in people's lives, because we bring them news information that they cannot get elsewhere. The impact, a lot of times, when we talk about our impact, people think we're exaggerating, but we're not. A couple of years ago, we got a letter. The host of our investigative report feature program, he got a letter from a retired cadre. He was in his 80s. He was a high-level cadre. And he said he had a heart issue, and he wanted to get treatment at the best hospital in town. But his retirement pension would only allow him to go to a certain hospital. And he said, I had dedicated my entire life to this country, to the party, and this is how they're treating me. We interviewed him. We interviewed the supervisor with his former work unit. We aired the report. A week after we aired the report, his former work unit told him, okay, you can go get treatment at the hospital of your choice. But next time, just talk to us directly. Don't go to a foreign radio station. But this is the kind of impact that we are looking at. I know people will say, oh, it's anecdotal. It's just one little case. But really, there are dozens of cases like that in the 15 years we've been on the air. I know for a fact we are making a difference in people's lives.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus on PCJ Radio. Now, Keith, you had some very sad news very recently.
Yes, that's right, Paulette. Last week on Wednesday, I received a message from someone by the name of Dante Monson, who informed me that his father, David Monson, had passed away. Now, David Monson had been was on a number of PCJ shows. He hosted with me an edition of Happy Station on December 31st, 2009, a special two-hour live program that we did. But David's history in radio goes back even further than that. He was did a very popular show on Brussels, on Belgian Radio International, BRT, called Brussels Calling. Now, David passed away, like I said, we found out in March. But this is not March 2012. This is March 2011.
Now that is quite a gap.
Well, it is a gap, but there's something that you have to know about David. You know, you if you send an email to me, chances are I'll reply right away, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you sent me an email and I didn't reply. A month went by and I didn't reply. What would you be thinking?
Well, the worst.
Right. You know, in David's case, if you didn't get a reply immediately, that's just the way he was. Sometimes you'd send an email, and then maybe 8 months later, then he'd decide to hit reply, and he'd reply back. And you'd totally forgotten at that point that you'd even sent an email.
I see.
This was David's personality. David was like that. Some people would say he was a scatterbrain. And I think maybe in some way he was. He was highly intelligent, extremely artistic, and could take something take a subject that is dull and all of a sudden bring life to it and put color in it. This was David Monson. This is why he was so successful when he hosted Brussels Calling on Belgian radio. So when I found out that he'd passed away, I let everybody know who knew him, and arranged a conversation with Bob Zanotti and Jeff White, who also knew him very well, to talk about what we all remembered about David Monson and what he was like and what made him so special. So let's take a little listen to that now. And it'll begin, by the way, with a little sort of retrospective, or you can say sound time capsule, of some of David's work.
Well, hopefully so, because you know I might be something of a sexagenarian myself. Yeah, forget about the prefix, but genarian, sexagenarian myself. Can you believe it? I mean, gee, my gosh, where have all those years gone? I mean, we all end up saying that, but you know, I feel more alive and younger than I've ever felt, possibly.
Maybe some of you have lived through or with, at some stage of your life, that sound, the sound of an erupting volcano. In Italy, Mount Etna appears to be building up a head of steam again, belching black smoke into the air and rumbling like a subway tunnel. The last eruption of Mount Etna was in March last year, and experts say it's still too early to determine whether she'll blow it up again. A report from Winston Lawton.
I'm standing where others lie. Many thousands of young men, many younger than myself when they fell, in what they said would be the war to end all wars. I'm standing in Flanders Fields.
I've got another work by Brahms to play too in the program. Not exactly light classical music, but a magnificent piece of oratorio that somewhere in the course of the program I'll find a suitable place to slot in. It just seems, though, that somehow, today, there's a definite tendency in my selection towards the waltz, the march, and the dance.
The most treasured memories of my life, in fact, were the years that I spent in London and being exposed to, of course, you know, the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, and indeed I had interviews and even met up with, at one time, right here, isn't it amazing, in Taiwan, with one of the big names, in fact, in the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Jeff, let me begin with you, because David gave me some tapes of a program that he did in South Africa called the Tuesday at 8. And one of them contains you calling in from Chicago doing a report about a snowstorm. How did you meet David? Because David was in South Africa at the time. You were in the United States. How did you meet him? Did he just call you up out of the blue and say, yes, yes, you've got to come on the show. Talk about the snowstorm.
I really don't remember how I first met him, except that I think I probably, you know, I mean, I was a shortwave listener, and I probably heard his program, Brussels Calling. Now, we did, and Bob knows this, David was a partner in an enterprise that we had called Radio Earth that I was also involved in. And I remember when I was in Curacao producing this, it was a daily one-hour program, David was doing commentaries from Belgium at the time, and he happened to find a payphone in Brussels that would make international calls without needing money. And so he would just call us up in Curacao every day and feed the commentary. But I also had traveled to Europe a few times and worked with David on planning some various projects. And we went to some EDXC, European DX Council conferences together as well.
Bob, let's get to you. Your connection with David Monson, how did you meet him?
A very similar answer to that our good friend Jeff just said. I'm not completely sure anymore, but I know it had something to do, pardon me, with a European DX Council meeting. And I don't keep book on it, but if my recollection is correct, it would be the late 70s when we actually were in Brussels. And I think David showed up at that particular time. And then there was another occasion, which is almost legendary. Ian McFarlane will remember this because Ian and I did joint reports about it. RCI and SRI, the two communications programs, worked together very often. And that was in Berlin in the spring of 1989, actually just a few months before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that was the occasion when David initiated the idea for International Radio Days, he called it. And this was meant to be a big meeting of major shortwave broadcasters to meet with the public and to try to explain and bring their message of international broadcasting to the public. And that brought us to Berlin, and that was the second meeting. On a very official and professional level, professionally, I never had that much to do with David. My contacts with him were mainly later on when he came to visit us here in the Emmental. He would call suddenly out of nowhere. You'd get a call from David saying, I'm in Europe, but I'll save those details for you later.
My meeting, David, of course, was thanks to the two of you. And even though I didn't know him as long as the two of you, he was, as far as I'm concerned, and I think he would be flattered if I said this, but I mean, there's no doubt about it, David was eccentric. David was very eccentric. And I recall a time in 2010 when I did a sit-down interview with him that was probably the most extraordinary interview that I've ever done with anyone, because it ran nearly 2 hours. And when I was editing the interview, I constantly had to edit out my voice saying, okay, David, good topic, but let's get back on to my original question. He'd start answering it and then go off in a completely different direction. And then I'd always have to like, okay, David, let's get back to the original question again.
That was typical, Keith. I think we all had that experience with him. Some people would call him, or might have called him, scatterbrained, and you mentioned eccentric. But you know, it's interesting. We all knew him, and I knew him fairly well because I can go into details later if you wish. He was here, and we had some really quiet, deep moments in long, late-night discussions. And this word eccentric, there's nothing wrong with that, but you know, in technical terms, in physics, anything which is eccentric is sort of out of the box. It's not in conformity, I should say, with the norm or the standard. Now, if you look at it one way, that could be an apt definition of creativity. And David was extremely creative, and it manifested as what people might call eccentric. Also, this notion of being a bit scatterbrained in his thoughts all over the page and so on. And this, of course, can also be the mark of a highly creative individual. The problem there is that he was not able to focus his thoughts, as you've said. I mean, he'd have, I guess they call it stream of consciousness in psychology. Anything that popped into his head, it simply grabbed him and he went off in that tangents all over the place. But his mind was never quiet. His mind was always working. I don't know if he ever really slept or rested. He was just a bundle of energy. I mean, a volcano of energy. And everything was in his mind. Everything was in his mind. His mind was never quiet. That's one way I would characterize David Monson.
Yes, he was always, his mind was always going in various different directions at the same time. And it was always ahead of his, you know, of his body, although he physically moved fast as well. And so he'd start out, he'd be doing a live, you know, commentary on the radio, and he'd start out talking about, you know, some aspect of architecture in Belgium, and he'd end up talking about eating 10 hamburgers at McDonald's or something. And it was, it was very interesting. And it was, and he had a hard time, you know, from what Bob said is correct. He was very, very creative and had a hard time accepting the concept of a dry script for a radio program. So what he would do, he was required to do that at Brussels Calling, but he would often record the program, you know, based on the official script in the daytime, And then after the editors went home in the evening, he would go back and go into the studio, and he had a good relationship with the studio operators, and he would go on live and do the program live, a totally different program from what had been pre-recorded with the script. But it was, and it was stream of consciousness programming, exactly. But you know, people liked that, in particularly in North America, and somewhat in Europe. I think it was very different from what was on most state-owned shortwave stations at the time.
It's amazing, you know, what I can see from my window, from our studio window. I'd feel rather like Bartleby in Herman Melville's short story. You remember him staring out at a blank wall? Well, I'd feel rather like Bartleby if it wasn't for the fact that the wall on the opposite side of my studio happens to contain floor upon floor. There are 11 of them. 1911, yes. Floor upon directors on the 10th or 11th floor, not quite sure. Perhaps he spends his life gazing down in my window. Now, floor upon floor of those asymmetrical windows. Now, it's not the asymmetry of the windows that interests me. It's the goings-on behind the windows that does, and I'm not sure sometimes whether the occupants of the offices they give light to realize that somewhere on the opposite side of the building, the eyes of a voyeur are at work, a peeping Tom at his dirty work. This could also end up sounding like the first chapter of a novel by a French existentialist. Ever heard of Babousse? I was always fascinated by that first chapter of L'Enfer, that's what it is, right? Hell, where the principal character is found almost on the first page, I think, peeping through a hole in the wall, or was it a keyhole? And he was peeping through the hole at his neighbors in the hotel room next door. If you want to know what they were up to, well, read the book. What's so wrong with wanting to know what the neighbors are doing, anyhow? Everybody wants to know what I'm doing. I mean, my neighbors, that is, my street. I'm treading on dangerous ground now, but I'm almost sure that... Oh, would you believe it? There they go again. Barbusse's hero. Almost sure that Barbusse's hero or anti-hero would have found as much delight in his unnatural pastime by working for the radio station. This radio station. Now, this has left you all guessing, I suppose. I'm sure you'd give anything to find out what was actually going on right now in our studio. You can only hear my voice, and I'll vouchsafe for the fact that I'm proper enough, but you should see how the rest of them carry on here when I'm on the air. Sodom and Gomorrah had nothing on our studios. You can believe me if you wish. To get back to the window. And by the way, this is the first chapter of an existential novel I'm writing. Getting back to the windows, then, and what I can see in the windows opposite our studio. Right at this moment of time, what looks like a young blonde combing her long blonde hair, her one or two long blonde hairs. In a moment she'll be laying on the lipstick. Yes, that's exactly what I thought. Yes, a touch of rouge to the right and the left cheek, a dab of powder to the brow, quick squirt of whatever deodorant to below the right and left ear. She stands back to admire her handiwork, deodorant to the right or left, yeah, under her arm. She stands back to admire handwork, her handiwork. She gives herself a kiss in the mirror and gets lost once again in her handbag, no doubt searching for the nail polish. I wonder what director she's going out with tonight.
Jeff, that leads me to the question, because in the 1980s, there was an album, vinyl, a disc that was released of some of the best excerpts from Brussels Calling. You were involved in that project. How did that manifest?
Well, David had the idea. I think it was, I'm not sure if he was still at Belgian Radio Television at the time or not, but he had those tapes of some of the mailbag programs and what he called his mobile monologues, which were these sort of stream of consciousness programs. And he picked out some of the best of them and talked about, you know, he said, do you think it would be a good idea to do an LP of these, and then we could give the profits to the Handicapped Aid Program in North America. And so Ian McFarlane became involved in this also, He was head of Handicapped Aid Program in Canada. And so, I don't know, David ended up making arrangements with a studio in Nashville, Tennessee, which produces most of the records here in the U.S., I think. And I handled some of the distribution and organizational matters on that. Yeah, it was Male and Mobile Monologues was the title of the LP.
You know, I've listened to it, and something that you mentioned a moment ago, it was very different from what most, let's say, state publicly funded international broadcasters were doing at the time. And you listen to it, and you kind of wonder, because in many ways, these, when David was at Belgian Radio doing Brussels Calling, it really brought, I would suspect, a lot more listeners, a lot of people thinking, oh, this is like a breath of fresh air. And the odd thing is that he never really had support from Belgian Radio doing this.
He did have a kind of a constant love and hate relationship with the BRT. And eventually, you know, he left because I don't think he could handle the situation there. I mean, but he, like I said, he found ways of getting around the bureaucracy there by doing things his own way. So just going back in at night and doing the programs live. But, you know, they had lists up, for example, of how many times an announcer would mention a product name. Or say God bless at the end of a program or something like that, and things that David would do, and they put them up on the wall, you know, to sort of make people look bad. And, you know, he didn't, you know, this wasn't the sort of thing that he liked, of course, but he grinned and buried it for many years before he left.
Well, this issue of his relationship, not only to Belgian radio, but also to Belgium, it was, I have to be careful here, but, I don't know. We had hours of late night discussion, and, he gave me the clear impression that he really wasn't happy in Belgium at all. In fact, he used a couple of expressions we can't use here on the air, but, no, he wasn't terribly happy. I think though, in all fairness, he was one of these wandering souls who probably was never happy anywhere. In fact, I'll confess, I'm a little bit like that. It just has to do with my being a Sagittarian or something, whatever that is. I've been told that anyway by the experts. And in David's case, he was definitely a citizen of the world, and he was very deep and very intelligent. And he also was very critical. He was not politically correct. I'm not either, but he certainly wasn't. And I think his attitude towards the radio station there was, don't get me wrong, don't take me literally, but in a way it was almost devil may care, almost a suicidal attitude. He was not a corporate politician. I think he somehow, this is speculation, but I always had the feeling he regarded the radio station up there in Brussels as somehow his own personal radio station. And he was going to push the envelope, as people say today, and see how far he could get away with it. Or he just never thought about it or never cared. There are some people like this who are, you know, we know them in corporations, in business. There are these people who we call them organizational politicians. You know, there are other expressions which are less flattering. David was anything but that. He was a seeker of the truth. He explained things or commented on things as a social critic and observer the way he felt it, the way he saw it. And I don't think the term censorship and certainly self-censorship would ever have occurred to him. And to be honest, I was surprised sometimes that he got away with what he did. Certainly you couldn't have done that kind of thing on a station like Swiss Radio International. Or most other stations I can think of, certainly not Radio Canada International. And yet he in a way, he pushed the envelope to extremes, and he got away with it for quite some time. But I think he was using, it was a kind of ventilation. The internet today, I mean, he could have his own radio station. In those days, you couldn't. I think today he would be a great success on the internet, and he'd be very happy doing that. But in those days, you only had one outlet to the world, and that was shortwave. And I think that's the medium he was using to try to address people and talk to the world about his ideas and how he saw the world.
I would venture to say that, you know, in a way, BRT and Brussels Calling was perhaps even more effective in presenting Belgium to the world because of David's format, or lack of format, if you will. I mean, he was a wealth of knowledge about things like classical music and the history of Belgium. And I mean, he loved Europe and this sort of thing. And he could talk about it. He could talk about it in a personal way, which was very different, you know, from these scripts that were prepared by most stations. And I think in many ways the program was more effective and perhaps a better way of presenting Belgium than the traditional way.
Hello, hello, France.
Hello, David.
Hello, Paul. Okay, you can hear me down there, can
yes,
you?
Yes, we can hear
on
you.
On the Kornmarkt. All right.
Okay.
Up here, that's me, yours truly, David Monson, on the tower of the Gravenstein. My gosh. If I have to climb another step today, or for that matter, climb down another step, I shall die on the spot, I swear. Anyhow, there's our technicians down there in the mobile studio on the Kornmarkt, and they've done a remarkable job of work. I can assure you, if they don't get a gold medal after all this, after their efforts over the past couple of days, well, we'll certainly make sure that you get the freedom of this city. I've spoken to the mayor about that, Paul in France. And
before we end off, I want to ask each of you to share some anecdote about David that you will certainly never forget. Who's going to go first?
Oh, well, I remember the very first time that I went to Europe. It was in 1981. And I was actually going, remember, Bob, you all sponsored the European DX Council conference there in Bern.
And that's right.
I was going to that, but I flew into Luxembourg on Iceland there, and I was going to stay for a few days with David in Brussels. And he picked me up. He said he was going to pick me up at the airport in Luxembourg. I got to the airport, and I was waiting in the customs and immigration lines, and they called my name on the loudspeaker. And so I got out of line. I went to an Iceland Air representative, and I said they called my name on the PA. And they said, yes, you have a message from Mr. David Monson. He says he is going to be delayed, but he will be there to pick you up, so wait for him. So I did. And sure enough, in a little bit, David arrived, and we were putting my luggage into his Mazda RX-7. And he explained that he was delayed because he had been in Brussels, and in a parking space, he backed into a car belonging to one of the African ambassadors to Belgium, and so he was tied up with the paperwork and the police reports and so on. So he was late picking me up, and then he said, the problem is I have to get back to Brussels in time to do Brussels Calling Live. So we raced back to Brussels from Luxembourg at about 160, 180 kilometers an hour, weaving in and out of traffic. I mean, David was like, you know, a race car driver. we got into Brussels, whipped into the underground parking garage at the BRT building, ran up a few flights of stairs, dashed into the studio, and, I mean, he had it timed perfectly. The pre-recorded newscast was just ending, and he went into the studio, sat down, they turned his microphone on, he motioned for me to come into the studio, and he said, welcome to Brussels Calling here on Belgian Radio and Television. I'm David Monson, and I have a guest with me here tonight. Jeff White has just arrived from the United States. Jeff, what do you think of Belgium? And I, you know, this is the first time I'd ever been to Europe, first time I'd ever been to Belgium, and I'd only been there for, you know, an hour or two. And I didn't know whether it was a joke or whether he was serious, and so I just said, well, David, it's kind of hard to see Belgium at 200 kilometers an hour. So... But this is the kind of programs he did, you know?
Well, I don't have anything that will top that, Jeff, but I have a couple of maybe contrasting recollections or maybe things you'll remember, too. I remember at one affair, David had, I think he was going to entertain us with a piano recital. He was quite an accomplished pianist, also Dante, his son, which is one of the reasons that... David wanted to move to Germany so he could have a better musical education. And you know, he put on a recital of, I think, Beethoven or something, you know, very staid and very standard. And then all of a sudden, I said, I will now improvise. Well, he went on. For me, it was a cacophony. And it was the oral version, the acoustic version of David's mind. It was all over the place. I mean, he literally, to try to give a vivid picture, he probably would be anybody's classic vision of the mad musician. His long hair flying, his head twisting and back and forth and jerking and all kinds of movements. And it was just, I mean, I wish somebody had recorded it. It was the acoustic rendition of David Monson's mind.
Jeff White, Bob Zanotti, thank you very much for joining us today on this program looking at David Monson, who we just discovered passed away March 2011. And we only found out about it last week. But as I mentioned earlier, if you didn't get a reply from an email that you sent, it wasn't unusual. Jeff White, Bob Zanotti, thank you very much.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you, Keith. It's been fun thinking and remembering back to some of the good times with David Monson. He'll surely be missed.
It's Beethoven Sonata number 3 in A major. Oh, you want to be really, you know, musical about it? Okay, opus, academic about it, opus 69. It's a sonata for cello and piano, forte piano and cello. I'm going to play the Scherzo Allegro Molto, and it's one of the most contagious, I think, versions and performances of this particular work that I've ever heard. Again, with Anna Bilsma, the Dutch cellist, and on forte piano, Malcolm Bilson. I'll tell you a little more about this afterwards, if we have time.
Well, it's now time to find out what's going on in the world of propagation. Here is our propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
The 10.7 centimeter flux jumps around just a little bit this week, starting on April 28th, with a 10.7 centimeter flux of 120. April 29th, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 115. April 30th, a 10.7 centimeter flux of 110. From May 1st to May 4th, the 10.7 centimeter flux remains stable at 105. The A index will be stable at 5 all week long from April 28th to May 4th, 2012. The KP index also starts out and remains stable with a KP index of 2 from April 28th to May 4th, 2012. Two sunspot groups are rotating out of view. Those are 1459 and 1460. 1465, 1466, and 1468 are in view at this time, with 1467 and 1469 just starting to come into view. April 23rd and 24th brought us geomagnetic storms that were so strong, auroras were observed in 10 U.S. states. April 23rd should have brought a minor coronal mass ejection. There is a 20 to 30% chance of more geomagnetic storms yet to come, as sunspot AR1465 has developed a beta-gamma-delta magnetic field that harbors energy for X-class solar flares. Because of the sunspot's location near the middle of the solar disk, any eruptions will likely be Earth-directed.
Thank you very much, Dan. Well, Paulette, guess what? We've come to the end of another monthly edition of Media Network Plus. If you wish to contact us, Paulette, what is the easiest way to do that?
Just send us a quick email, mnp@pcjmedia.com.
That's right. And if you want to listen to this program again, as well as all past editions of the 55-minute version and the weekly 30-minute version, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. That's www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. We also invite you to check out our Facebook page so you can get involved in some interesting discussions, as well as post some news that you may have heard about that we hadn't heard about yet. Mm-hmm. All right, so on behalf of myself, Keith Perron in Taipei, Taiwan.
And me, Paulette McQuarrie in Vancouver, Canada.
We hope that you join us all again very soon.
Thanks for joining us. Talk to you again soon.
73s to you all and 88s to the ladies.